I should begin by apologizing. So I had originally given a different title, and that was some work in progress. And in the end, I got some cold feet, so I decided to switch. But a priori, I don't think there will be much moonshine here. Maybe, you know, eventually there's moonshine in everything, but there will certainly be something modular, and there will certainly be string theory. So that should at least fit in this workshop anyway. Yeah, and there will be something. And in fact, I mean, this workshop deals with VOAs, which are infinite dimensional, and now I'm going to do Katz-Moody, which are also infinite dimensional. So it should be okay, I think. So this is work with some people who are not here, so I figured I should give you some pictures. So this is work with my student, Henrik Gustafsson, Axel Kleinschmidt, Potsdam, and Philip Flaig in Paris. And it's actually some work that has been ongoing for some years. It takes a lot of time. But there are two papers so far, and then there is a big review that we're writing that will probably turn into a book. We'll see. So what will happen here? The main question is, we want to understand the structure of string interactions. And I will focus on one aspect of this. So I will focus on sort of a space-time perspective here. So most of the talks here in this workshop have done things from the point of view of the world sheet. But the point here is that we have strong constraints by symmetries, in particular supersymmetry and u-duality. So when I think about u-duality here, I'm talking about some arithmetic Lie group. So it turns out that amplitudes have very intricate arithmetic structures controlled by some discrete subgroup of a Lie group. And in implementing this or analyzing these kind of symmetries, we learned a lot. We learned about ultraviolet properties of gravity, black holes, and it also led to interesting mathematical predictions from string theory, and that's something I really want to come back to. So the setting I have in mind here is this famous sequence of groups that you get when you compactify string theory on tori. So if you start in 10 dimensions, there is a classical symmetry SL2R, and it's known that this is broken by quantum effect to SL2Z. And as you go to higher and higher tori, to lower and lower dimensions, these groups get enhanced, culminating in E8 in three dimensions, where you have a quantum or discrete symmetry group E8 of Z. And the main message here is that if you're looking for observables, some couplings in this theory, they're given by functions, first of all, in this classical moduli space, which is the group G divided by its maximal compact subgroup. And then you have this additional quotient by the discrete subgroup. And there's been a lot of work over the years on this. But there is some part missing here that I want to focus on. So conjecturally, if we would continue down to two dimensions, to one dimension and zero dimensions, you end up in the realm of Katz-Moody groups. So you start with two dimensions. It's actually known that gravity in two dimensions becomes integrable, and that's controlled by an affine Katz-Moody group. And then you're supposed to get hyperbolic and Lorentzian Katz-Moody groups as you go down. So it's interesting to ask, it doesn't make sense to talk about discrete subgroups here. Does it make sense to talk about, couplings in this theory in terms of automorphic forms and Katz-Moody groups? Perhaps there are many issues here. The mathematical theory is much less developed. You expect that there will be new kind of funny instanton effects. It's not really clear how to define the u-duality invariant effective action. Yes?
On what objects do these groups act? Because the BPS states in higher dimensions are well defined.
Yeah.
But the BPS states in very low dimensions have divergences?
Certainly. I don't have a good answer. So I'm going to explain how to overcome some difficulties, but mainly from the mathematical side. And then I'm going to leave it to you and me and eventually maybe understand the physics. But there is something here that really suggests that many of these things make sense, although the proper analysis of how this group actually acts, I can't tell you. No, so I mean, for instance, if you look in two dimensions, you would expect to have like D7 brain instantons and so on. And it's been analyzed particularly by Jan de Boer recently, suggesting that if you go to, say, two dimensions and lower, you would actually have instanton effects that go like, the order of e to the minus one of the string coupling to some higher power. And those are expected to appear in these dimensions. And as I will show you, we actually seem just find that this is this happens. So yeah, so what happens is that you can start with some nice dbrain configuration that go like just 1/g. And then you act with the u-duality, you look at the orbit, you will actually find really funny mass terms here that will correspond to what I call exotic ones. And they will actually contribute to okay, so this is the plan. I want to start by talking about what is known. And then I'm going to go to this new aspect of looking at this from the point of view of Katz-Woody groups. And I will end with some speculations. So the setting here is that we're interested in looking at corrections to Einstein gravity in some dimension, 10 minus n, where n is the dimension of some torus. And the first few terms, so we have the Einstein-Hilbert action, and the first correction is given by a quartic term, which is a certain quartic correction in Riemann tensor. And then you also get terms which correspond to derivatives of the Riemann tensor and so on. Now, I want to focus on the functions here. So in front of here, you have some functions of the moduli of the theory. So this G here parameterizes a point in the classical moduli space. But if this thing is invariant under the u-duality group, then these functions must be invariant. So they must be invariant under these discrete subgroups. But actually, we know more. So if that was the only thing we knew, we wouldn't be able to pinpoint what these functions are. But if you look at the supersymmetry of this of these couplings, it turns out that they require that these functions satisfy certain differential equations. In particular, they should be eigenfunctions of the Laplacian on this moduli space. And even more, they should have a very specific eigenvalue. But moreover, we have calculated these terms at least at tree level in one loop, so we know how they should behave in some weak coupling expansion. So they should have a well-defined weak coupling expansion when you take the string coupling to be small. So if you take all these conditions and combine them, then you go to the math literature and you say, well, this is exactly what, let's say, Harishchandra defines as an automorphic form. Now, from the point of view of moonshine, this is a little too strong because typically moonshine would have different conditions here. But this is typically what a mathematician talking about automorphic forms from higher rank groups mean. So let's see how this actually works in the simplest example, or as kind of the canonical example, which is type 2b in 10 dimensions. We can do this very explicitly. So we start. We take the R4 correction to Einstein-Hilbert gravity, 10 dimensions. The coupling here will then be a function of tau, where tau is the axial dilaton, which parameterizes a point in the upper half plane. So what we know that this should be invariant under SL2z. Now, if this was a holomorphic function, we would know that this would be more or less ruled out if we demand that there is no singularity. But this is not a holomorphic function. We don't demand holomorphicity here. But what we do demand is that this is an eigenfunction of the Laplacian on the upper half plane. So this is the form of the Laplacian, and here is just x plus iy. So this is an example of a mass form, if you want. And it turns out that if you restrict to this specific eigenvalue, and moreover, we know what is the leading term here, because that has been calculated early on, that should be the tree level correction to this term, and it goes like y to the 3/2, y is the imaginary part of tau, and in terms of the string coupling, this is really the weak coupling limit. And if you combine all these conditions, there is a unique solution. Turns out that this is a unique solution. It's given by a sum over two integers like this. In fact, you could have expected there would be some cusp forms that come in and actually modify this, and that would not destroy this weak coupling expansion. But it turns out that at this particular value of the Laplacian, the spectrum of cusp forms is empty, so you're actually fine. So this motivates us, first of all, to understand better this class of functions, and then we want to push it to higher rank groups. So let's take a look at what these functions really are. So it's an example of a non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. So we consider this sum. We take the sum now over co-prime integers y to the s. So this is now a complex parameter s. This is a function on the upper half plane by construction. Here you can see that this is actually completely invariant under SL2z. It converges absolutely for the real part of s bigger than 1, and it has the following eigenvalue under the Laplacian. Now, this is a very classical object, and it was shown first by Selberg that, in fact, you can meromorphically continue this, analytically continue this to meromorphic function of all the entire complex plane. And the way to do that is just to compute the Fourier expansion completely, and then you can see that all the terms actually have a well-defined continuation to all of s. And in fact, the Fourier expansion is important for us. So, well, you have the obvious thing that you have a periodicity in tau, and that will tell you that the general form of the Fourier expansion will be something like this. You will have a zero mode, which is the constant term. Now, in this case, these are not holomorphic, so the constant term is not really constant. It's really independent of the real part of tau. So it will depend only on y. And then you have an infinite series of non-zero modes with some coefficients fn that can also depend on y. Well, so if you calculate this, it's not a difficult calculation. You see that the constant term actually has two contributions. It's given here in terms of the completed Riemann zeta function. If you compute this infinite, these non-zero coefficients here, you find that they are given by modified Bessel function and a certain number theoretic object, divisor sum. So you can do this in various ways. The standard way is to take the original sum and you manipulate a little bit, you do a Poisson summation, and you get this thing. Of course, the moduli dependence here in terms of the Bessel function, for instance, you can obtain directly just by applying the Laplacian here, and you get a differential equation for f. Okay, so what is the physics in this? Well, the claim is that the actual function that appears in string theory is 2 times zeta of 3 times this particular Eisenstein series evaluated at s equal 3 halves. So from that point of view, you see that the constant term looks like this, and that has a direct interpretation as the tree level and the one loop contribution in the Einstein frame. So these were calculated beforehand, and they are perfect matching with this Eisenstein series. And in fact, there are no further, these are the only constant terms. So here you get the non-real normalization condition saying that there can be no higher loop corrections consistently with S-duality, SL2Z symmetry. Well, then you look at the rest of the coefficients, and what you do is you take this Bessel function here, and you say, okay, well, in the weak coupling limit, I expand y goes to infinity. You can expand the Bessel function, and you get an infinite series of perturbative terms here, weighted by e to the minus s, where s is the instanton. This is the classical instanton action. So you see that these terms are in fact exponentially suppressed in the weak coupling limit, and this number theoretic object is precisely what we would call the instanton measure, more or less counts the number of instantons of charge n. So this is a pretty amazing thing. This is perturbatively and non-perturbatively exact. And this was really a Green and Gutt-Perlet that proposed this, and it's been now subject to many different checks. And, well, the goal here is to see, can we actually push this further? What about if you go to higher tori, lower dimensions? Does this kind of argument still make sense? And I want to start to convince you that it actually does. So before I do that, I have to introduce a little bit of mathematics. So I want to talk about how do you actually go from this Eisenstein series on SL2 to some higher rank V group. Now there are some, there's a kind of a very canonical object that naturally generalizes the Eisenstein series I just talked about. And it's the so-called Langlands Eisenstein series on some semi-simple V group G. This is the form. It's given in terms of a kind of a Poincaré sum. So what are the ingredients? Well, G is a Lie group, has an Ivasova decomposition in terms of a Borel and a maximal compact subgroup. The Borel decomposes into NA, or you can think of the A just diagonal matrices, and these are from a physical perspective like the dilatons. The N is an upper triangular group, and then you can think of that as parametrizing axions in the theory. So the other ingredient here is this H, which is a so-called logarithm map. It's a map from the group G to the Cartan subalgebra, which is the Lie algebra of the torus. And effectively, it just takes you from H, N, A, K to the logarithm of A. Lambda here is a complex weight, and rho is the Weyl vector. So this is the ordinary Weyl vector, not the weird one that John was talking about. And okay, so here, amazingly enough, you can prove a lot of things about this. And this is one of, you know, there's a 270-page paper by Langlands that is completely unreadable. One of the main achievements is they actually proves that, you know, although this converges absolutely on a certain subspace here, you can actually do an analytic continuation to the entire weights, complex weight space here. Yes, yes, a simple roots. Sorry, yeah. Yeah. This is manifestly invariant under the discrete subgroup. It's invariant under the maximal compact subgroup on the right because of this logarithm map was defined in that way. It's an eigenfunction of the Laplacian with an eigenvalue determined by the weight. So this is a nice object. Let's just briefly take a step back and see how does that actually connect with the thing I talked about before. Well, I talked about this sum, and the claim is that you can write it in this way here. And the way to see that is, first of all, you pick the weight, lambda plus rho, in this way. This is 2 times S, where capital lambda is the fundamental weight of SL2. It's just half the simple root. The logarithm map just picks out Y times the Cartan generator, using that the inner product with the fundamental weight here is 1, and then realizing that this sum here is nothing but the sum over coprime divisors, you can see that this is indeed a direct, an equivalence, and then you immediately see how to generalize it to this case.
Sorry,
yes?
You have an exponential on the right-hand side.
Yeah. Where are you? If you write this out, this is just imaginary part of gamma times tau, right? This is exactly what you get.
So how do I get from the exponential down to C tau? I'm missing a logarithm.
No, well, the logarithm is in here. Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're missing. Yeah, sorry. I missed. Yeah, you're missing a log. Yes. There's a log. Sorry.
Oh.
Yeah. Sorry. You're missing a log. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. You need the log. Okay. So what about in order to extract physics from this, we want to do the Fourier expansion. Now here you have a challenge because it's not so easy. The periodicity that we had before. Well, what does that correspond to? It generalizes to the fact that okay, there is a discrete subgroup of upper triangular matrices that leaves this invariant. But this is now non-abelian, so you have to think about what you actually mean by Fourier expanding. You cannot just Fourier expand a non-abelian group. So you can actually show that there is a general structure to this expansion. First of all, you can easily see that there should be a constant term, like a zero mode. And we expect that, you know, if this had some physics in it, this would correspond to perturbative effects. Well, that remains to be shown. There is a term here that I will come back to what this is. This is what I would call an abelian coefficient. So there is a way to structure the expansion such that you pick out an abelian part, and then so you have kind of an hierarchical structure here, and you will get extra terms which are non-abelian coefficients. So this is the way to do it. You have to sort of structure it. And of course, if n was abelian, then all you have are these two terms.
Constant means it's constant under a left multiplication.
Yeah, yeah. So the terminology comes from, you know, in a holomorphic case, that would be constant, but here is no longer constant. Yeah. So indeed, let's look at the constant term. So the constant term is defined as the integral of this shift with a shift of n and integrating over a fundamental domain of this unipotent group. So, you know, physically you can think of it as integrating out the axions, so that would give you the perturbative terms. Now, amazingly, Langlands has actually proven a very general formula here that this thing is given by a sum over the Weyl group with some coefficients here, where m is what he calls the scattering coefficient. It's given by a product over positive roots of completed Riemann zetas. Now, I think you can actually go further. You can generalize this. What if you take another unipotent? I mean, you don't have to take n. It's kind of the biggest unipotent you can take. But you can take a smaller one, and you can ask, well, what happens then? That means you're not integrating out all of the axions. Then there is a similar type of formula, a sum over not over the full Weyl group, then with these coefficients. And then E here will then be an Eisenstein series for a subgroup. And that actually is very relevant for string theory, because sometimes, you know, we have take different limits. And in fact, sometimes you want to calculate this kind of thing, and then you would expect to get some Eisenstein series left. So I will look at this kind of example a little bit later. But these are very general statements, and it's quite amazing that you can actually do these calculations for higher rank groups. But okay, so how do you see the physics? In the case of 10 dimensions, we just have more or less just one direction to expand. In other cases, you can ask about, okay, you can, if you're in a lower dimension, you can ask, what happens with this coupling if I take a decompactification limit? So I take a radius to be large. Then the perturbative parameter will not be the string coupling, it will be the radius of the decompactified circle. The non-perturbative effects that you see will be Kalitza-Klein instantons and BPS instantons coming from BPS states in one dimension higher that wrap the circle. And that corresponds to a certain choice of a unipotent group. Another limit would be the string perturbation limit, where you actually expanded the string coupling, and then you would see D instantons and NS5 instantons. Or you can think about having the volume of the M-theory torus big, and then you would see M2 and M5 Brein instantons. So all of these correspond to taking different unipotents and making the Fourier expansion. So let me offer you an example. In the case where we have type 2 on T4, then we are in 6 dimensions, not in 4. And so let's look at the analog of this coupling here. The claim is then that the Eisenstein series that you should put here is the general one, but when you fix a very specific weight. So you pick the lambda to be 2 times s, where lambda 1 is the fundamental weight of the first simple root minus rho, and then you fix this s to be 3/2. Then choosing a suitable unipotent, you can calculate the constant term, and the constant term takes this form. You have 2 times the Riemann zeta over the string coupling squared. This is precisely the tree-level contribution. Here you get an Eisenstein series for S044. And that's exactly the one-loop term, because if you think of what is the one-loop term, it's an integral over the fundamental domain of the torus, the world sheet torus, integrated against the Narayan theta function for the lattice gamma 4, comma 4. And that is known to give an Eisenstein series for S044.
Don't you have to choose a normalization of the Haar measures?
Well, here, I mean, since this unipotent, what you actually do is that you, when you integrate this, that will just be, I mean, this will just be a product of integrals from 0 to 1. So I think in this case, there is no. Yeah, there is a choice. Then it must be. So we're using Langlands choice, but that's a good question. I think there's a canonical.
So
here I'm actually giving it in the string frame. So in fact, there is a rescaling that I forget here, because this would come out in Einstein frame. I'm giving this in string frame just to, but yeah, there's a, just like it was in 10 dimensions, this is really, it comes out in Einstein frame. There's an overall factor of the, yeah, of, well, y here, so the imaginary part to give you to this, so yeah. But yeah, whether there is some interesting choice of this Haar measure, I haven't thought about. Okay, so, but there is a lot known. So this is just one example. In fact, people have now checked this for higher tori. So it turns out that if you go all the way down to three dimensions or to E8, then you can do this for the same choice of weight for the R4 term, taking s equal 3/2, for the d to the 4, r to the, yeah, so here there should be a derivative. You take the same weight, but you fix s to be 5/2. So it turns out that if you take the d4 r to the 4 term, you have to choose a different weight here. Then you, people have checked this to against perturbative string calculation. It works miraculously well. In fact, you can also go higher, but that's a little more complicated story, so I won't go into that. No. So these are different supermultiplets. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, I can actually look at, you know, the R4 term comes in a multiplet, and you will get different Eisenstein series, and they are related by acting with the supercharge of these mass operators. So that's indeed true. But these two are in different multiplets. Yeah. So what we want to do is we want to see, okay, can we push this? Does it even make sense to push this to infinite dimensional groups? It turns out that, you know, there seems to be a way to do this. So let me tell you a little bit about how to think about automorphic forms on Kac-Moody groups. You can just start and think about this formula and ask, you know, does this make sense if you take G to be Kac-Moody? First of all, you have to ask, well, how do you define this G of Z? Well, Hull and Townsend in seven dimension in four dimensions, they define E7 of Z to be the subgroup of E7 that preserves the 56-dimensional charge lattice. Now, you can actually prove that that's equivalent to defining a Chevalley group. This is a Chevalley subgroup of E7. And so the conjecture is that if you go down, you should define these as Chevalley subgroups of the Kac-Moody groups. And they are indeed well defined. You can look in papers, for instance, by Cartier and Carbone, and Garland and Carbone, that these groups make sense. What about convergence? Well, Howard Garland established convergence in the affine case. There's been some work on rank 2 hyperbolic, actually establishes convergence. There's some generalization of the constant term formula that is known. But the main message here is that this is really something that is being, you know, developed as we speak. There are, you know, increasing number of mathematicians starting to think about this, and they are partly motivated by trying to find new L functions and so on. But so let's look at some of the details. If we look at the constant term here, then this formula, the sum over the Weyl group, potentially would have many, many problems if you want to interpret it from string theory, right? The Weyl group has infinite order. There are infinitely many roots. So how would you ever try to come up with something that matches with string theory, where we have only, we expect that there should be a finite number of perturbative terms? Well, so in fact, this was solved by Philipp Fleid and Axel Kleinschmidt. They noticed that if you take this special choice of weight that seems to come out of string theory, this infinite sum here collapses to a finite sum. In other words, infinite many m's here vanish. There seemed to be something very nice about this particular weight here selected by string theory. Sorry? Yeah, exactly. This is where the zeta function, yeah.
So you're one of the trivial zeros in the zeta function.
Yeah. So it turns out that particularly for this choice, you actually find precisely that you're using the zeros of the zeta function, yeah. Okay, so what we want to do, we want to see, can we extract some instanton effects from this? Can we extend this to actually compute honest Fourier coefficients of this. Well, then I have to tell you a little bit, how does this, what is the structure of these terms? Well, before I gave you the constant terms, let me tell you what this non-zero mode looks like. Well, what it looks like is you take this integral against the Eisenstein series, but now you take a non-trivial unitary character on n, which is trivial n of z. So if you think about it, this is just a fancy way of talking about a Fourier mode. So let's go back to the example of SL2 again. Well, I'm saying that this character here takes an upper triangular element, and think of this as just being e to the x times the Chevalier generator, and it brings out a Fourier mode where m is an integer and x is a real number. So indeed, this is trivial when x is an integer. And I'm using the terminology that psi is generic when m is non-zero, otherwise it's degenerate. And that's the terminology that we'll use later on. And then you can just evaluate this integral here. And the character is parameterized by an integer. The sum, the integral over the fundamental domain is just an integral from 0 to 1. And you integrate this explicitly, and you reproduce this Bessel function that I showed you before. So that's how it's worked for SL2. Now, in general, a unitary character is known to be a function only on the abelianization of n. So in fact, this only sees sort of the product over the simple roots. So it's a product over the one-parameter subgroups corresponding to the simple roots. So this means there is a very simple way of parameterizing this character. It's just the e to the 2 pi I and sum. But you can think of the mjs as instanton charges, and the x's are axions. And then I'm saying that this terminology that I used before, well, generalizes nicely. So if all of them are non-zero, then psi is generic. If some of them are non-zero, are zero, then it's degenerate. Depending on how I choose the character, psi will take a different form. But one thing that is, well, surprising maybe initially, is that if you take a Kac-Moody group, if you do this for a Kac-Moody group, and you try to evaluate this, it turns out that this thing is always zero if psi is generic. It's a very general fact, and it has to do with the fact that the Weyl group does not have a longest Weyl word. So when you evaluate this, you actually do that in a little more fancy setting. You go to the Adels, and you use the Bruhat decomposition, and you can show that the only contribution comes from the longest Weyl word. And there is no such Weyl word, so it vanishes for Kac-Moody groups. So that motivates us to try to calculate this for degenerate Whittaker vectors. So that's what we did. So we derived a very general formula that if you have a degenerate character, so you have at least one of these instanton charges is zero, you can actually show that there is a formula for this that is given, take kind of a similar form as the formula for the constant term of a non-maximal unipotent. And the miraculous thing is that it's given in terms of Whittaker vectors, which are generic on a finite dimensional subgroup determined by the non-zero charges. Here, there are some details here. W prime is the longest Weyl word of the Weyl group of that subgroup. And this is a generic Whittaker vector. So this is kind of a very nice and explicit formula that we can now start to calculate. We can actually work this out for some examples. So let's take a look. Well, let's do this for E10, which is kind of a nice hyperbolic group. This is a highway in Lofoten in Norway that is apparently has a nice name. It's on the other side. Yeah. So what we find is that if we now take this E10 and we say, suppose there is such a thing as an R4 correction, you want to understand. Taking this Eisenstein series for E10, evaluating it at this particular choice of weight, s = 3/2, then we can calculate all of the non-zero contributions, and this is all there is. So it turns out that the only non-zero contributions are those where all the charges except one vanish. This means that you have a character which is, you know, non-zero on the first root, on the second, on the third. So you have 10 contributions, each of which is given by a Bessel function. So B here is just a Bessel function times this summation measure. So it's a very nice simplification that more or less what happens is that it looks like a sum of things that live on SL2.
What are the V's?
The V's are parameters on the Cartan. So these will correspond to, you know, physical parameters like the radii and so on. Yeah, so what is the physics in that? Well, let's take a look. If we start expanding these Bessel functions, we will see that indeed we get things that look exactly like the instanton effects. But as I mentioned, we actually get arbitrary powers of the coupling, which a priori may look funny. But indeed, already in two dimensions, it's known that you have an infinite series of Gerroch potentials. And those are precisely expected to give these higher powers. So what we think is that this is really showing that there are these exotic instantons that actually contribute to these couplings. And you know, we are trying to understand the physics of this much better and do it in more detail. But it really seems that you have this kind of funny phenomenon, that you get an infinite series of these instanton effects that contribute.
The whole notion of the effective action is much
more. I completely agree. So you can take a pragmatic point of view. No, but so what you can do, for instance, does this make sense if I do a decompactification limit? It should, you know, it should actually capture all of the functions that you have, let's say, in three and four dimensions. And indeed, you can do that. So you can see that what you have is something like a big device that captures all of the others.
But these things go away.
Yeah, these things go away, exactly.
And also, the gravitational back reaction, once n is sufficiently large, is divergent and weak coupling.
I agree, yeah. So, you know, this is nice, but it's also suggestive of some nice mathematical structure. You can ask, what is it that is really going on? I mean, why does this collapse happen? And, well, our conjecture is that what it actually means is that these Eisenstein series for E9, E10, and E11 are attached to something called the minimal representation. So, what this means is that we are actually talking about representations of Lie groups acting on function spaces. So it doesn't make sense to talk about the dimension of the representation in the ordinary sense because it's infinite dimensional function space. But you can talk about how many variables do the functions depend on. That's what's known as the functional dimension or the Gelfand-Kirillov dimension. And it turns out that there is, for all finite dimensional simple Lie groups, there is the smallest non-trivial representation. So for instance, for E8, it turns out that the smallest function space where you can realize the E8 action is 29, functional dimension 29. So it's functions of 29 variables. But in the case of infinite dimensional, that it's harder to make sense of. But indeed, it's known that for, let's say, E7, E8, automorphic realizations of these min reps have very, very few Fourier coefficients. So this thing of having a collapse of the number of coefficients is really a sign that you have something minimal. And indeed, it was shown by Greenmiller and Van Hove and Piolin that in the case of E7 and E8, these are precisely the functions that appear are minimal realizations of minimal representations. But for the Katz-Moody case, it's highly non-trivial because in particular, these interpretations are defined using the notion of nilpotent orbits, minimal nilpotent orbits of the group. And that's a concept that doesn't really exist mathematically for Katz-Moody groups. But somehow, what this collapse that we find is highly significant and somehow tells you that these should be viewed as defining minimal representations. And we're trying to, at the moment, work out if we can use this to make some statements about these reps. So that's kind of a nice way where string theory, you know, still gives you some nice mathematics. Okay, so let me just wrap up. So what else can we do? Well, the formula that we have, although we initially derived it for the purpose of Katz-Moody, we can actually, you know, it works very well in higher dimensions. So we are trying to, at the moment, work out some instanton effects that people have not been able to work out previously in higher dimensions. You can also ask about couplings that preserve less supersymmetry. So in particular, I talked about the d to the 4 r to the 4 term. If you go to d to the 6 r to the 4, it's known that what was previously just a nice Laplace condition no longer holds. So supersymmetry now requires that these functions are some funky new objects that satisfy a Poisson-type equation, where on the right-hand side, you have like squares of Eisenstein series of smaller groups. So this is just being analyzed, and it's, you know, people call this generalized automorphic forms. Terry says that one should never use this word generalized because then someone will come along and generalize it. So maybe maxi automorphic forms. it's natural to ask if you can actually push this and define this for Kac-Moody groups. Well, we also want to try to get explicit formulas for non-abelian coefficients. And then, of course, you can ask about the Langlands program for Kac-Moody groups, which I'm not really going to do, but there are people, in particular Braverman and Kashtan, have started to work out some of the ingredients and try to push this. So yeah, that's all I have. Thanks, you. Yes?
Are there special properties of the Fourier coefficients for minuscule representations? I'm wondering if there are minimal representations.
Actually, I've been wondering the same. I've been reading this paper by Jacob Lurie on minuscule representations. I think it's the same thing, but I'm not entirely sure. It's a good question. Yeah. No one's going to ask about moonshine? Yeah. So one thing that in this story, one of the key ingredients that goes into this is the notion of an automorphic representation. And this does not seem to have a nice interpretation of, if you start thinking about J functions, you have poles at cusps and so on. Those do not fit into a nice framework. All these things we're talking about here are Hecke eigenfunctions, more or less, and that doesn't hold for moonshine. So, in fact, in one of Borch's first papers, he has an open question asking what is the proper interpretation of all these Borch's lifts and so on from the point of view of automorphic representations. And I think it's still an open question.
There's no more questions.
Thank you.